Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
And good morning and welcome to First Coast Connect. I'm Dan Scanlon, sitting in this week for Ann Schindler. Today, school is out for the summer, but the heat is on for many district officials, including the newly hired superintendent, Dr. Christopher Bernier. Later in the program, is the country on track to reach its carbon emissions-free goals by 2035? We'll talk to a local expert about the future of electric vehicles and a bunch of other stuff. But first, Duval County Public Schools has a permanent leader at the helm who is inheriting many issues that have plagued the district. Megan Malicote, education reporter for JAX Today and a person who sits right next to me in the newsroom here, is joining us to discuss some of the challenges that the school district faces. Megan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Dan.
You know, it's interesting. I've been listening and watching you and the news as to what is happening in the school district. Dr. Bernier was sworn in last week as superintendent and by all accounts has hit the ground running. So let's talk first about what has led up to bringing this man on board and then what is he doing since the school board officially voted him in, 2 weeks ago?
Yes, well, his arrival here in Jacksonville was like the end of a search process that took about a year. And it required two different search pools of candidates, if I remember correctly. Now, I joined the team more recently than that, but it's been a long process getting to this point. So it's good that he's out there now. He's been out in the community doing meet and greets. He met with the NAACP chapter earlier this week. And he seems to be trying to get a feel for constituents' needs, concerns, and things like that.
Now, we remember very well that the vote from the board was 6-1, and Warren Jones basically saying that he wanted Bernier on the job but had some concerns about the high salary. But what were some of the issues that you uncovered as he was leading up to that vote from his former Lee County position?
Well, the big thing that we broke was a whistleblower complaint that was put against Dr. Bernier in Lee County, where he came from. He was the superintendent of schools in Lee County. And shortly before he left, there was a whistleblower complaint filed against him that he was that he racially profiled an employee, that he was very gruff and angry and things like that. And so the interesting thing that stood out to us was that when the whistleblower complaint was lodged, he stepped down as superintendent about just a couple of days later. It wasn't long at all. And you don't always see superintendents, step away that quickly.
He left the job. His house was up for sale the next day. Very quickly, this happened. And I guess there were some concerns or questions about that.
Yes. So we talked to our school board. I personally spoke with Chair Willie, a couple of different times, and he assured us that they have done their due diligence is the phrase that he likes to use, that they, I guess, contacted references that they felt were involved in the situation and that they were reassured that, it's going to be okay. That of course, it's not unusual to see, high-level administrators end up in positions like this. He's also named in a couple of federal civil rights lawsuits about a incident with a baseball team in Fort Myers that was a racially charged kind of thing. And it's not unusual in and of itself to see high-level administrators be named in these types of suits and complaints and things like that. And so Willie and the rest of the board feel confident that they, these things will work themselves out.
Well, he has certainly stepped into a group of a bunch of problems that have already existed, along with the fact that we have a large number of school board races up for grabs. What are some of the issues that he is facing that he has to start dealing with and getting maybe his people on board or getting the district to start working on this?
Right. So I think if you ask members in our community what the biggest issue facing the district right now is, it's probably the presence of that master facilities plan that suggests closing more or less 30 schools, give or take, consolidating and things like that. So that is a big deal to people in our community, and rightfully so, because closing a school is not an easy decision. You know, there's reasons why you would do that in some cases, and there's reasons why you would want to keep a neighborhood school open in other cases. And so before Dr. Bernier arrived, the board was in the process of doing a series of like community meetings and to hear from each of the seven districts, and you know, what the question they kept asking was, what makes your school special? Why should we keep your school open? You know, what is it that separates you know, your school from some of the other schools in the district? And so Dr. Bernier actually attended, I think, three of those meetings and listened. He just kind of sat in the audience quietly, listened to the public comment portions of, you know, people from the community who would get up and again say support for their, it was typically elementary schools. So I think that's going to be top on the list of his to-do list, you know, as he gets started here in the coming months.
Yeah, but a lot of these schools are known in the past for having very high grade levels.
Yes.
They've also been very popular with parents because they're in, some of them are in long time subdivisions like Grove Park, Atlantic Beach, where the kids can walk to school. But
right.
Those, again, are not the reasons to keep a school anymore. The reasons are, in some of these schools, there's very low population count, and you have to consolidate because I guess the costs are way too much to operate a school when you've got empty classrooms.
Well, that's right. And I think that brings, that becomes more of a philosophical question at that point, and how we want to operate schools in the American education system, right? Is it important to have the neighborhood school that a child can walk to or ride his bike to, but might have 200-300 students? Or is it better to operate these schools at a much more cost-effective point where you have maybe 800 students, but they're farther away from communities? They're not maybe the central hub of the community life in that neighborhood. The board is facing those questions now. And I don't think that there's a single right or wrong answer there, because there's certainly points to be made on both sides.
There's even the issue that some of these schools are in communities that need, or they feel they need, the neighbors feel they need to have a school in their neighborhood, in their community, because that gives it some credibility. Some of the north and northwest sides neighborhoods that might lose these schools, that's a school that has become legendary in that community, and you don't want to lose that identity, I guess.
Absolutely. Some of these schools, you know, they date back to the early 1900s. I mean, Duval is a very old school district. It's one of the oldest school districts in the state. And so it's hard to think about shutting down these neighborhood schools, but it's also difficult to see how a school with just a couple of hundred kids can be financially feasible. So it is a very top level concern for Dr. Bernier and the full school board, as you know, there's the majority of the board will turn over here in August.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, four to seven seats will be decided during the August 20th primary vote, and the winners take office in November. And that means the potential for a lot of new faces looking at some old problems. So what are some of the goals that have to be held, have to be worked on by this old or new or half new school board?
Yes, it does. So two of the members, Lori Hershey and Warren Jones, are getting term limited out, so they are not running again. And then Dr. Kelly Coker decided not to run again. So the only incumbent race is the one with Cindy Pearson in District 3. So there will be a lot of new faces. Now, I believe that District 5 has three candidates running, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that means that one candidate would either have to get a majority or it would go with the top two candidates to the election in November. But most of the seats will be decided in the primary in August. And so it will be interesting to see how that changes the character of the board and the way that they think about these issues. I don't know that there's a way to predict how that will go.
If you're just joining us now, we're talking about the summertime break leading up to fall school and all the issues that the school district will have to face. And we're talking about it with our own Jax Today's Megan Malicote, who's been covering a lot of this over the past few months. You can join the conversation live on air by calling 904-549-2937. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out on social media. Now, Megan, What are some of the other issues that the school district is going to face, the school board's going to face, either the old, the new, or the mix?
Well, another issue is the student safety plan that Dr. Krznar presented or published kind of on her way out the door a couple of weeks ago. It is not entirely new. There were some new things in it, but it was 20 points. So it was a very detailed plan of changes to make it regarding student safety in the district, because of course the Douglas Anderson issues, let's say, have also been a frequent talking point in the district. And so on her way out the door, Dr. Krznar did publish this 20-point plan to help keep students safe. And then, so she published, I like to think of it as that she had more of a human, you know, easily read type of plan. And then those safety points are backed up by district policies. And so at the July meeting, the school board had some changes to the district policy on the agenda, but they decided to postpone the vote because the general counsel's office that's working with the district to help work on these Douglas Anderson related issues decided that really the legal background of these policies needed to be kind of rebuilt from the ground up, that they were working with policies that were originally drafted in the 90s. And so it would be better to kind of rewrite them rather than continuing to make changes here and there. And so my understanding, based on what they said at the board meeting last week, was that their changes are done. They just weren't done in time to put them out for public review in time for the July board meeting. And so they anticipate bringing them for a vote in September.
Now, you think about student safety. For me, the former parent, now grandparent, I think of student safety as the physical safety of the child in a school from exterior, maybe not interior issues, but this safety policy is born from something else, and some of that led to one former teacher going to jail, right?
Yes, it did. Jeffrey Clayton is a name that's well known in this community, unfortunately. And so Dr. Krznar's changes have a lot to do with teacher behavior to protect students from inappropriate conduct of teachers and sexual safety.
And the issue here especially was that apparently there was some issues going on at a certain school that were not being reported. And in fact, the State Department of Education got on the district's case about the apparent inability to post those complaints to the right people.
That's right. Manny Diaz's office at the State Board of Education did. He's been in touch with Dr. Krznar's office and before her, Dr. Green's office, on and off over the last couple of years, trying to better hold accountable the district or to ask, you know, what the district is doing to protect students in Jacksonville. Most recently, I think it was in May that they sent another letter to Dr. Krznar asking, okay, so what are you doing about these issues? And Dr. Krznar's response said, you know, we've already made a lot of changes, and then here's some more changes that are coming. So one of the things that they did was they surveyed Douglas Anderson parents and stakeholders to ask, with these changes, you know, here's some suggested changes, A, B, and C, does this sound appropriate to you? Does this sound like it would help prevent the types of things that we've seen over the last many years, unfortunately.
And we talk about Jeffrey Clayton at the sentencing hearing, while the victim that the one charge or the main charge against him did speak out. There were others who were there who were not part of the criminal charging that also discussed. So there were issues that many say should have been sent to the board or the district and were not acted on or were acted on much later.
Right. I think acted on much later seems to be the thing here. And so one of the changes that the district made was that they developed an electronic system for reporting. And I suppose like anything else electronic, that makes it easier to report incidents in a timely manner and then share them with the various places that they need to go.
So what's the general response right now as we're awaiting the final vote on this? Is this something A, necessary, B, should have been done, C, will be easy to roll out and get done, and D, they expect some response
It sounded like it. The board was largely in favor of the changes. In fact, they said, you know, the general counsel's office actually asked the board to either vote down or delay the vote for the changes that were proposed in July. And the board was concerned how that would look because they were, by and large, decent changes. I mean, changes that most people would look at and say, out of common sense, yes, let's make those changes. Things like being required to report incidents in the, you know, the change in the language behind it so that you're required, not, you know, asked or suggested, I suppose. The board didn't really want to delay the vote or vote it down because they're eager for these changes to take effect. And so the general counsel's office, it assured the board that the changes are actually already in place, that the superintendent's office has said, okay, so make these changes, but the legal backing behind it is what needs to be backed up. So it's not that they can't, you know, go ahead and proceed with the new procedures. It's that they want the backing of the legal policies to be changed as well. And that's what they're going to do in September.
And as we've got a caller just here on hold, don't forget, obviously, the $1.45 million lawsuit to settle settlement that the board approved last week, brought by other Douglas Anderson students. So it shows that that maybe this is the right time to roll out this plan and try to stop the other stuff that's happening.
True.
All right. Let's talk to Catherine in Avondale. Catherine, you're on the air and you've got a comment on research. Catherine?
Yes, hi. I want to go back to the school closure question for a minute. I was just wondering what research the district has done on the effects of school size on achievement.
Yeah, they've always said that a small class size is especially important to academics. So, Megan, what do you think about that question?
Right. Well, as you'll remember, many years ago, on the Florida voters voted to limit class sizes as a constitutional amendment. And we've seen class sizes kind of grow from there because the state recently has removed all penalties for not following those regulations. So while it's still a constitutional amendment, the class sizes need to be limited. There is no repercussions for not doing it. And so that makes it kind of tricky to enforce, I suppose. But the district's original master facility plan was based solely on, it was made by an outside consultant. They only asked them to look at things like where the districts overlapped and, or where school zones overlapped and where schools were heavily, had a very low population and things like that. So that's a great question about what research they've done about, smaller schools versus larger schools. I think that gets back to the question that we mentioned earlier, is that it becomes kind of a philosophical thing, that there are certainly benefits to small schools and small classes. You build a sense of community in the neighborhood schools that way. But there's also some fiscal advantages to larger schools. So it will be interesting to see which way the district swings with that.
You know, it's interesting, too. I'm a longtime reporter, and you're a longtime area resident. St. John's County was at one point one time where it actually had to go to double sessions because it was so overcrowded and schools weren't ready yet. And now they're building schools left and right. Their academics on the surface seem to be very good. But I wonder if those class sizes of the Bartram Trail High School double sessions are coming back to haunt them because they had to jam so many people in one building.
Right. Well, and that's still an issue in St. John's County. You know, it's almost the opposite problem in St. John's County that it is in Duval, is that they can't build schools fast enough in St. John's. But in Duval, they're having to discuss, closing schools. And, you know, like I said, Duval is one of the oldest school districts in the state. Some of its buildings date back so far that you can see the effects of things like Jim Crow and so forth, in the way that some of the buildings are so close together because you have black schools and white schools right next door to each other. And so in today's world, of course, it doesn't make sense to have two schools be so close that you can stand on the front steps of one and see another. So there's some work that needs to be done in Duval that's not part of St. John's list of issues. But then there's also problems in St. John's that aren't affecting too
much. Where you can actually stand on the front porch of one and see another, like in the Fruit Cove community. We've got an email from Laura. She wants to add that some of the beloved A-rated neighborhood schools are also at capacity, and they're on the waiting lists, with waiting lists. And so what about the question of these schools, along with some of them being actually historically designated?
Absolutely. My understanding is that the district has now asked a consultant to go back and review the original plan and then all the feedback received from the community. And so as Dr. Bernier starts, you know, his tenure here, that they will review all the feedback that they received and come up with another plan, I suppose. Now there's a regulation in Florida that you can't close a school unless it's been announced. I think it's December, so you have to give a fair amount of notice. So the board was initially hoping for a final plan in November. But since the superintendent turned over, I don't know if that's still a reasonable expectation or not.
And obviously we have some schools that are being built. Some schools are being consolidated into some of these new constructs. And that's all coming from, I believe, the half penny tax that was approved.
That's right. That's right, the half penny sales tax. I believe that it was a delay with one of those construction projects that caused the board to stop and look at a more broad top level perspective from some of these schools, because construction costs have skyrocketed mm-hmm. in recent years, right? So it changed the cost that they had originally gotten into, signed up for with the half penny sales tax and then what they called their bold plan to build new schools in certain strategic areas.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Holiday Hill is building their new facility literally in an old ball field next to the original facility, so that the Southside Boulevard overpass, the walkway mm-hmm. that students use can still be used. I guess that's a logical choice if you have the land nearby and you can build new versus expand. But that, I think, sure. is the only project that I can remember that's actually happening now. Is that correct? Or am I right?
I believe that they paused all the projects that they could pause that made sense to pause.
Okay. Now, here's other issues as we are literally within, a month of school starting, is how are Duval County students measuring up to students in other Florida school districts? And is that a concern, again, for Bernier and that school board, new, old, mixed, coming in?
Well, I think the way that a district students measure up is always a concern for its leadership, right? So last week, the state released the results of the standardized testing. So right now the third graders through 12th graders take a test called the FAST test. And the FAST test is only 2 years old. This year was the second year administering the test. And so you can't rightfully compare the scores from this year too far back, but you can compare it from this year and last year. And so Duval's, for instance, in English language arts, scores from third grade to 10th grade. I'm looking over my exact statistics here. They 43% last year and 46% this year are considered to be on grade level or above with language arts topics, which is below the average of the state of Florida. The average of Florida is 53, and our neighboring counties are much higher too. For instance, St. John's that we just mentioned, they're at 72% this year. So I think that's something that the new superintendent and the board will certainly be looking at.
We're improving, but we're still not as good as other districts are, I guess.
That's right. So, you know, any progress is good progress, I would say. But there's certainly more opportunity for progress. I think it's important to remember too that so the third graders who were the youngest children taking this test were in VPK the year that COVID hit. So their entire time in the school system has been marked by the changes that COVID brought. And it will be interesting then too to compare the different grades, and the test has changed. So there's so many moving parts here that it's hard to compare too many different ways, but it's important to remember the lived experience of these children as they're taking these tests, is that they did not have a normal experience in kindergarten, first grade, and they're probably just now getting back to some sense of normalcy as they then start to take these tests.
Oh, I remember the virtual classes for our grandson, and that was extremely difficult for him to focus on. And you and I are talking right now via video link, so it's rather intriguing. First time I've not had a guest in studio, I understand, and I want to look at you on the screen. So, you know, now, obviously, we are. So what you're saying is it's the first time really that we're looking at a student body that exists in real time in a classroom versus looking at statistics that were back in the COVID era, back in the getting your education via phone line or a video line. And so now maybe Dr. Bernier has everybody where they should be to now study and work on. Every warm body is where they should be, and you can observe how they are in person.
Right. So, you know, if you think about when a child learns to read, it's what, you know, kindergarten, first grade. And so these children were going to school largely virtually or, you know, in a way that was very disrupted then. Of course, there's lots and lots of other factors going on. And these were problems all across the state. We're not unique in that. But I like to remember that perhaps because I have a child who is in that age range that, you know, when I think about how he started school, it's just so different from how we would have expected a child to start school.
Well, we've got a phone call right now from Hank on the north side. And Hank, what's your question? You're on the air.
I guess my question is, if you have a child that's have a low reading capacity and you try to and you get with the school about it to help to get that child some help, but they decide to still promote. They still promote the child. What do you do in that instance?
Boy, that's an age-old question. Thank you for that, Megan.
Well, I am a big proponent of getting to know your child's teacher very well and being an active participant in the community at your school. Probably lots of the participants or lots of the supporters of these local community schools would probably echo that, is that the best thing you can do for your child's education is to make is for your child's teachers and administrators to know you by name. And so when issues like that arise, then you can take it up individually, and then they kind of know where you're coming from in those circumstances.
Yeah, and from personal experience, obviously when you do get to know the teacher and the staff, then there are discussions that occur and you can conceivably decide together, maybe this other program at this other school is the one that the child can go into versus promoting, I guess.
Absolutely.
Now, we've got an interesting question from Eugene on the north side. Eugene, let's talk about the new school's construction.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
And to the hosts and our guests. Quick question, or maybe a comment. I had a chance to visit down south, South Florida, Miami in particular, and something I noticed they did and are doing, instead of building new schools, what they're doing is they're putting the schools on stilts almost. I mean, it's like the school used to be one story, now it's three stories. They basically built it up almost like a high rise. Is that something that's being considered in Jacksonville instead of going out securing new property and going through all the rigmarole of, you know, just starting a new school right across the street from a new school, or the old school, when they can just build two more levels onto the old school and be done? It'd probably be a lot cheaper.
All right. Thanks, Eugene. You know, some of that might have to do with resiliency and the fact that the school is in a flood zone, so let's move it all up. But what about actually adding on to or augmenting? I mean, certainly some of Megan, the oldest schools in the district, the original school building is the core and office space now. And now they've added or adding, some of those were portables. Now they're adding buildings next to it.
Right. I haven't heard of any discussion to add additional stories onto the buildings. But yes, that is a common thing with the older buildings, the small portions, and so that they then build out from there. But I think, too, some of the consideration is that it's harder to upgrade an old building right, than it is to build a new one sometimes. And with today's construction prices, they take that into account. Of course, that does not take into account the history and the personality of the old school buildings. And that's what a lot of the supporters of these neighborhood community schools would tell you, is that it's not the same to raise a historic building and build a new one.
Yeah, that was very tough with the decision for a certain Northside High School that is very historic to actually move it to another location and build new because it was necessary. And the alumni who date back 50, 60, 70, 80 years, a little bummed that they're losing their alma mater there.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, you know, it's interesting. There is an historic high school on the city's west side that had a fire on the top floor back in the 80s. And what the district did was they basically consolidated classes in the gymnasium and auditorium with partitions, cleared out the top structure, and the school is now one story shorter using the building.
Oh, my goodness.
It was intriguing to actually see that happening. But let's go back to what's the political fallout if you eventually, as a school board, close a school that is historical, that is historically academically high scoring, that is in a neighborhood where power leaders have walked their kids to school and they don't want it to go. I mean, there's signs on in many neighborhoods saying save our school, and that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Right. I think it's hard to predict the political fallout, but certainly you can hypothesize anyway that neighborhoods don't want to lose their community schools. So it's it will be interesting to track how politics factors into the final decisions and for whether to close schools, build new schools. That's certainly something that we'll keep an eye on.
And when it comes to the safety rules, is there any expected immediate impact? Could some long buried complaints surface in other schools? Could there be a rush to actually file a concern from a parent or another teacher?
I mean, I don't know about a rush coming in, but I think that it's always possible that a long buried complaint could come up. I think that happened at Douglas Anderson too, that when the complaints started to surface, that other complaints followed about other staff members. And so, I don't know that I hope that a rush doesn't happen, because that would be horrible for the students involved.
Yes.
But in the interest of prioritizing safety, if there are issues that need to arise, then it would be good to resolve them.
Well, Megan, here we are early in July and school hasn't even started. You're going to have a very busy next few weeks, and I'm sure I'll hear it all since you sit right next to me. So that's Megan Malicote, our Jax Today education reporter with a lot on her plate. So thank you very much for coming on with us today. Up next, plugging into the future of electric cars. We will be right back.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks. Hey, welcome back. Since their invention over a century ago, the auto industry has been driven by two constants, a fuel-burning engine and a human driver at the controls. Yeah, if you go back in the history books, steam and electric power seemed promising, but there are many stories of people trying to use the old crank start, breaking a thumb and dying of injuries. So the electric starter came in with Cadillac, and then suddenly the steam cars, the electric cars, no matter how promising and how quick and how easy to operate they were, sort of fell at the wayside. And now we're finding EVs are coming back. And I'll tell you, I do car reviews, and our guest here does his own version of car reviews. So let's talk to the guy who knows all about electric vehicles now and lives right around the corner from me, Bill Bortsfield, the host of a very, very popular online vlog called EV Rider. How you doing, Bill?
I'm doing great, Dan. I really appreciate you having me over today. And, of course, it's great to reunite with you because, of course, I used to work at WJCT, and we have a long history together as colleagues over at the Florida Times Union back in the day.
Plus, we're gearheads, and you know what I'm driving before I do because you see it in my driveway. Bill is a gearhead. Bill and I did a lot of fun stuff. We actually did a Pod Rods a blog back in the day at the Times Union, and he has become a converted EV lover, has three EVs, charges them up, and then gets out there and talks to owners of new and old, including the gentleman we see at Caffeine and Octane with a modified Volkswagen Beetle, and has actually, as I do, tested many electric cars and owns a vehicle that has autonomous equipment. And so we share a lot of the same thoughts. But I'm a little bit of a Luddite when it comes to going fully EV. He is a little more converted. So let's talk about the modern evolution of EVs. It started with the Volt. No, it started with...
Well, it started with the EV1 that General Motors did way back in the day.
With lead-acid batteries.
With lead-acid batteries. And I got to drive that back when I lived in California. And really, that was an eye-opening experience in and of itself. But as you know, the real advent of modern-day EVs would be the Tesla Roadster, which was a wonderful sports car and the first electric car to do more than 240 miles, which at the time was saying something. Now, of course, EVs, the opening bid is pretty much 300 miles or more for many of the performance EVs.
Yeah, the original Tesla Roadster was a converted Lotus, which was very lightweight, 1,000 pounds.
Beautiful car.
And very stunningly built, and I'm still waiting for Elon to bring out the promised next Roadster, next sports car.
Yes.
But as late as 3 weeks ago, I was driving an electric vehicle. I drove the Mustang Mach-E GT, which blew me away with its ability to handle with its technology level and its legitimate 250-mile range. And I guess that's my break-even, is you got to give me a gas tank's worth of...
Well, that's probably what you got, because I know you, Dan. You're a little heavy on the accelerator.
Oh, it's a
but
GT,
it's,
man.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, its actual EPA-rated range is 280. And as a Mustang Mach-E owner myself, I can tell you with a lighter foot, I either match or exceed Ford EPA / estimated range. So I would expect the same to be true with the Mach-E. Now, here's the thing. I know a lot of folks say, oh, EVs are all about the environment. And certainly that's true. But you brought up the Mach-E GT. And a quick note for performance fans. That car is a hair quicker than the V8 Mustang Dark Horse, and that's what it's all about.
And actually, there is a performance model that's just coming out, sort of rally wheels and stuff like that. So they know what they're aiming at. And now we have announced today the new Capri, which appears to be a modification of that platform, not like the Capri sports car,
One is actually going to be built on the Volkswagen MEB platform,
which is a superb platform.
Yes. In fact, they've already introduced the Ford Explorer over in Europe on that platform. So one of the interesting things to see, too, is you're seeing some unusual team-ups in the space. So to see Ford work with Volkswagen like that, it's just not the type of thing you would have expected. And, of course, I know you're also very familiar with the Rivian deal that just happened.
That is a stunning-looking vehicle with that really weird cross-frunk in front on the, I think it's the pickup truck. There's a lot of them in town, and I love them. But you and I share one commonality. We've both driven what I think is the most logical, luxurious, and competent electric out there, the Lucid Air.
Yeah, the Lucid Air, I was lucky enough to have for a week to review. And that thing, real world, has right around 400 miles of range per charge. And, of course, I had the absolute base model.
Rear wheel drive, yep.
If you were to get the bigger battery, you can go over 500 miles. But more importantly is luxury and performance that car has. It is, as you know, it's a stunning looking sedan, and sedans, really, gas or electric, fairly rare to see them these days.
Well, we've got a call, but I'll ask you this question before we go to Mark on the West Side. What are the pluses and minuses right now of owning an EV in Jacksonville?
Well, I think there's a lot of pluses. Among the pluses, fuel costs. Fuel costs are so much less with an EV. I'd have to look up JEA's kilowatt rate today to give you an exact number, but roughly it cost me about $12 to fill up my Mach-E at home. So to me, number one is the cost savings. I've got 41,000 miles on my Mach-E. The only expense I've had so far, I've picked up a nail or two, so I've got two replacement tires, but of course you get nails and
gasoline.
Welcome
to the club, yeah.
Exactly. Other than that, the car's been bulletproof.
Now, what are the negatives? Because you and I actually went out one day in an electric I was testing, and I won't say where it was, but we went to the two chargers, and one was wobbling on its stick, and the other one didn't work.
Yeah, I'd say the biggest negative right now is the nationwide charging infrastructure. Depending on where you live, there are issues. There's no question about it. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. When you are traveling, there are times when you'll pull up to a charging station and there's a car or two that you've got to wait to finish up, or worse, there might be a stall or two that isn't working. In fact, I was just reading this morning, though, the good news about that are all the fixes and expansions that are either already happening or coming. So, for example, Electrify America has been spending the last year ripping out the old unreliable chargers and putting in new ones. As you well know, a bunch of the major automotive automakers have banded together and they're rolling out another 30,000 stations. So,
and the biggest news is that
actually it may not be stations, it may be stalls. Let me make sure I
multiple car companies are working with Tesla to get the modification or the adapter so that you can plug into a supercharger.
As a matter of fact, I just got my adapter last week.
Okay, let's go to Mark on the West Side. Mark, you've got a question about electric vehicles. Hey, Mark.
Yeah, you just mentioned, you just mentioned something that I've been researching, and I was very surprised to find out that it's costing less to fill up your electric car and drive around the town than it is to go buy gas. At least surprised about that. But my concern is, and I can't get a straight answer on this, but I drive the heck out of my car. So in 2 or 3 years with my Tesla or whatever car I decide to buy, I'll have 300,000 miles on my car, and I'll probably have to replace the batteries. And how much does that cost? I've heard 10,000. I've heard 20,000. It's kind of scary.
Yeah, and I can address some of that. First off, every new car comes with a 8-year, 100,000-mile warranty. Now, Mark, if you're doing 300,000 in an automobile, you're obviously the exception to the rule. So as far as cost goes, one of the reasons it's so hard to figure out what the cost is because there's not many batteries that have gone bad yet. Now, I can give you a real number from real life. We owned a 2008 Prius, and it sat for months and months in a college garage, and at 140,000 miles after sitting so long, the battery went bad. In that case, it was, at the time, would have cost about $2,400. But of course, they have smaller batteries than a full EV.
You know, so, Bill, we're going to have to bring you back again to talk more about this. Well, I'll leave you with this note. Over the weekend, NASCAR showed their 1,000 horsepower all-wheel drive electric stock car prototype. So the future is here, and it could be fun. So, Bill Bortsfield.
It will be fun.
Bill Bortsfield, EV Rider. If you haven't looked at that blog and look at what he does with his tech, you're going to love it. And we will be back soon with some interesting information.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at LifeSouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
I'm Lisa Mullins. NATO members are meeting in Washington, D.C. to talk about military support for Ukraine and growing strategic competition with China. Also, three Republican women senators in South Carolina are voted out of office after stopping a total abortion ban from passing in the state. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
In a major shift, Boeing has pleaded guilty to federal felony charges related to two deadly crashes of 737 MAX jets. The Justice Department says the company conspired to defraud the U.S. government. We'll take a detailed look at Boeing's two most recent CEOs and what went wrong under their leadership. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11, here on WJCT News 89.9.
World leaders have gathered in the nation's capital this week to mark NATO's 75th anniversary. President Biden says the alliance is the strongest it's been in decades, but his future hangs in the balance with an upcoming news conference that could determine his political fate. How might he and NATO navigate the challenges ahead? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we are back. You know, podcasting is a thriving industry. In Northeast Florida alone, there's more than 500 content creators doing podcasts on a wide range of topics. Bill Bortsfield, EV writer. But one thing they all have in common, they're members of Jax Podcasters United, a supportive community for creatives by creatives. So right in front of me now, Botter Milligan, Blythe Brumlev, co-founders of Jax Podcasters United, or JPU. Sounds like a Jacksonville Power Unit, which it probably is. So thanks for being here, guys. And again, I will admit freely, podcasting not yet in my window. So tell us more about Jax Podcasters United and what you do for those who do podcast.
Well, I will say you do have a wonderful radio voice, if no one's ever told you that.
I think it
would work well in podcasting. So the Jax Podcasters United, or JPU as we like to call it, is a networking group. It's a community of podcasters here in Northeast Florida and beyond. Honestly, we've had a lot of people from out of state show up to some of our meetups. But it's a networking group that we started in 2018 with the simple mission of uplifting and empowering the podcast community here in Northeast Florida. We meet on a quarterly basis. We do workshops. We do webinars. A lot of it, 99% of it, is free. We team up with local sponsors like Buzzsprout, one of the biggest podcast hosting companies in the world, to throw these events. And we help aspiring as well as veteran podcasters level up their game, find ways to monetize their shows, and really anything else that we could do to support the podcast scene in here in Northeast Florida.
Yeah, because when you think about podcasting, especially when you're a podcaster, it's very lonely. You don't really have a team. It's a team of one. And a lot of the audience that you're talking to, you don't get to interact with them. And so for our meetups, which have a networking component and then an educational component, really are designed to help those aspiring podcasters. And we really, really push the value of community over competition. And so that is our bread and butter. And so we do that in a variety of ways, whether that is in-person meetups, which we truly believe in, and then also with online education through content.
Yeah, for those of us who spent 2.5 years in their bedroom doing news at my previous job because of COVID and not having that personal connection, I am so in love with being in a newsroom with human beings to interact and toss ideas with. And I do understand that if you're staring at a cell phone with a ring light for half an hour doing a blog, that's not fun. That's not interactive. And please tell them to take off their glasses. It's very distracting to see the ring light in their glasses. There must be a better lighting source than that, but I understand budgets are budgets. So quickly, how did you guys get into this? I mean, I've got my cell phone. I've got my sticks. I've done some stuff on this, but maybe I should start doing some blogs. So how did you get involved?
Well, for me, I really got started with podcasting because I come from a radio background as well. I was a host of co-host of a show called Helmets and Heels on 1010XL for 5 years, you know, Jaguars kickoff, that kind of thing. And I frankly wanted a little bit more airtime. I wanted to, you know, have that airtime to talk about things I wanted to talk about, more sports, more entertainment. And so I started up a podcast in order to do those things. Did that for a while and then transitioned into my more of my full-time role, which is in logistics and supply chain, which is an odd, you know, sort of shift from sports and entertainment to logistics and supply chain. So now I host a show there, and using that show, we kind of teamed up with his show as well. So now we co-host a show together along with the, you know, the JPU group and kind of helping facilitate that growth. But Botter's been a podcaster for, you know, longer than I have. So I started in 2014. Botter, you started
in 2012, someone came up to me and said, "Hey, you like to talk a lot. You want to get on the mics and
talk?" Wow, is that a 16 millimeter film camera? Someone cranking it then? No.
You know, it's funny. When I started podcasting, it really felt like I was giving a training education every time I met someone and told them, "Oh, I podcast." And they're like, "Oh, what's that? You know that purple icon on your iPhone? Yeah, that's a podcast catcher." But yeah, in 2012, I was working at a comic shop. I had a few friends that I would just, you know, debate about movies, talk about music, and we would stay until the shop closed. And eventually one of our friends started a podcast with a separate group, and the person that owned the equipment for that separate group gave him a chance. His name is Walter Gant, to, "Hey, you want to, if you ever want to use the equipment to do your own podcast, like, feel free to." So Walt invited myself and Drew to start the Short Box podcast. And I've been doing that since 2012, and we launched the JPU in 2018. So, yeah.
So you stress the in-person, and indeed, I was actually on a podcast during COVID talking about science fiction, and we had some really cool guest stars, and there were two or three of us because I've got the broadcasting background, and there was somebody else involved, and so I do understand how much fun that is. It's a little sloppy. I mean, you really should be producing or pre-producing some of these segments. So what are you helping podcasters streamline and clean up the product so that it's actually watchable, listenable?
Yeah.
The beauty of podcasting and with our in-person meetups is that there's no shortage of topics to talk about. There's no shortage of struggles that these podcasters are going through. So the big topics that always continuously come up is, how do I market my show? How do I make money off of my show? And then from the editing side of things. And so from the editing side of things, that's a little bit more challenging to teach in an in-person environment, but it could be a situation where we explore those topics again in the future.
Okay, Jack's Podcasters has a July meetup, July 18th, 6 to 8, 5133 San Jose Boulevard. So gentlemen, ladies, thank you very much. And thank you very much, Botter and Blythe. And let's just say that right now, that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send either to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. If you missed anything, catch our rebroadcast at 8 p.m. or find our entire archive at WJCT.org or on your favorite podcast platform. Executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. Our show is produced by Stacey Bennett and directed by Brady Corum. Jamie Vallee is our associate producer. Daria Miranova is our production intern. Our theme music performed by Club de Belugas. Join us tomorrow, and we'll be talking about some interesting things in the Middle East. I'm Dan Scanlon. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.